for the purposes of your body, soul, and
the hour of the time may be contacted at HOT, that's H-O-T-T, P.O. Box 940, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, in the state of Arizona, 85925. Our phone number is 928-333-2942, and our website is www.hourofthetime.com. Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. As you know from that intro, you are indeed listening to The Hour of the Time. I'm your host for today. It's Robert Houghton here, and today is Wednesday, March 16th, 2005. As always, you can check out our website. It's www.hourofthetime.com. Once again, that's hourofthetime.com. If you'd like to contact either myself or Doyle, you can go to the hourofthetime.com website and find our addresses listed there under the contacts link right at the top of the page. My email is webmaster at hour of the time, and Doyle can be reached at hourofthetime@hotmail.com. Our mailing address is, as always, ladies and gentlemen, HOT, that's H-O-T-T, P.O. Box 940, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona, 85925. Phone number in Eager is 928-333-2942. Phone number up here at the Canadian studio is 613-733-4324, and I just got a call on that line last night from the gentlemen that are producing the documentary out of New York, and it looks like they'll be heading up here sometime in April to do some filming, I guess an interview with myself, and probably then heading back down to Eager just to wrap up some of the footage that they hadn't collected yet from down there, and that will probably be the last trip. They're looking now for a November release date for the documentary on Bill, so things are going well with that particular project. We're also continuing the symbology in Canada's capital. Doyle and I are working on the script, I guess you could say, for that one. A lot of the video footage is already done. We're just compiling that together, and hopefully that will be out well before November. Yeah, we're looking for a beginning of the summer release for that, I guess, at this point. Got a lot of new shows coming up. Doyle's going to be doing The Meanings of Fairy Tales, which is very interesting. And tonight, or this afternoon, today's topic is going to be Edgar Allan Poe's Cask of Amontillado. And is there Masonic symbology in that? We have a piece of research sent to us by fellow researcher. I'd like to thank you for that, Ray. I know you're out there somewhere listening, and we're going to be doing that piece today. So thank you for tuning into the Hour of the Time, ladies and gentlemen. Once again, I'm your host, Robert Houghton. You're listening to the Hour of the Time on WBCQ The Planet, 7.415 megahertz and 9.330 megahertz. for those researchers out there who'd like to check up on some of these sources for today's program, we're going to be reading Edgar Allan Poe's Cask of Amontillado. Now, this is from, I'm reading from a book called Tales of Mystery and Imagination. It's a collection of Poe's work. You can pick up a copy of, there's probably several editions of this book available. And then the analysis of the Cask of Amontillado has been taken from a book called Critics on Poe, Readings in Literary Criticism. It's edited by David B. Kesterson, published by the University of Miami Press out of Coral Gables, Florida. And it's got a copyright date on it of 1973, and the particular article we're going to be citing from is written by Catherine M. Harris, entitled Ironic Revenge in Poe's The Cask of Amontillado. So let's begin with the tale, ladies and gentlemen. This would have worked better at our 11 p.m. time slot when things were a little bit more spooky. So if you can close your blinds, maybe go down to your basement with your shortwave, shut off all the lights, light perhaps just a small candle, to cast shadows on the wall, and join with us for Poe's The Cask of Amontillado. The thousand injuries of Fortunato I had borne as I best could, but when he ventured upon insult, I vowed revenge. You, who so well know the nature of my soul, will not suppose, however, that I gave utterance to a threat. At length I would be avenged. This was a point definitely settled, but the very definitiveness upon which it was resolved precluded the idea of risk. I must not only punish, but punish with impunity. A wrong is unredressed when retribution overtakes its redresser. It is equally unredressed when the avenger fails to make himself felt as such to him who has done the wrong. It must be understood that neither by word nor deed had I given Fortunato cause to doubt my goodwill. I continued, as it was my wont, to smile in his face, and he did not perceive that my smile now was at the thought of his immolation. He had a weak point, this Fortunato, although in other regards he was a man to be respected and even feared. He prided himself on his connoisseurship in wine. Few Italians have the true virtuoso spirit. For the most part, their enthusiasm is adapted to suit the time and opportunity, to practice imposture upon the British and Austrian millionaires. In painting and gemmery, Fortunato, like his countrymen, was a quack, but in the matter of old wines, he was sincere. In this respect, I did not differ from him materially. I was skillful in the Italian vintages myself, and bought largely whenever I could. It was about dusk one evening during the supreme madness of the carnival season that I encountered my friend. He accosted me with excessive warmth, for he had been drinking much. The man wore motley. He had on a tight-fitting party-striped dress, and his head was surmounted by the conical cap and bells. I was so pleased to see him that I thought I should never have done wringing his hand. I said to him, "My dear Fortunato, you are luckily met. How remarkably well you are looking today. But I have received a pipe of what passes for Amontillado, and I have my doubts." "How?" said he. "Amontillado? A pipe? Impossible! And in the middle of carnival!" "I have my doubts," I replied, "and I was silly enough to pay the full Amontillado price without consulting you in the matter. You were not to be found, and I was fearful of losing a bargain." "Amontillado! I have my doubts. Amontillado! And I must satisfy them. Amontillado. As you are engaged, I am on my way to Luceschi. If anyone has a critical turn, it is he. He will tell me." "Luceschi cannot tell Amontillado from sherry. And yet some fools will have it that his taste is a match for your own. Come, let us go." "Whither?" "To your vaults." My friend, no, I will not impose upon your good nature. I perceive you have an engagement. Musashi, I have no engagement. Come. My friend, no, it is not the engagement, but the severe cold with which I perceive you are afflicted. The vaults are insufferably damp. They are encrusted with nitre. Let us go, nevertheless. The cold is merely nothing. Amontillado, you have been imposed upon. And as for Luceschi, he cannot distinguish sherry from amontillado. Thus speaking, Fortunato possessed himself of my arm. Putting on a mask of black silk and drawing a roquelaure closely about my person, I suffered him to hurry me to my palazzo. There were no attendants at home, and they had absconded to make merry in honor of the time. I had told them that I should not return until the morning, and had given them explicit orders not to stir from the house. These orders were sufficient, I well knew, to ensure their immediate disappearance, one and all, as soon as my back was turned. I took from their sconces two flambeaux, and giving one to Fortunato, bowed him through several suites of rooms to the archway that led into the vaults. I passed down a long and winding staircase, requesting him to be cautious as he followed. We came at length to the foot of the descent and stood together on the damp grounds of the catacombs of the Montresors. The gait of my friend was unsteady, and the bells upon his cap jingled as he strode. "The pipe," he said. "It is farther on," said I, "but observe the white webwork which gleams from these cavern walls." He turned towards me and looked into my eyes with two filmy orbs that distilled the rheum of intoxication. "Nitre?" he asked at length. "Nitre," I reported. "How long have you had that cough?" My poor friend found it impossible to reply for many minutes. "It is nothing," he said at last. "Come," I said with decision. "We will go back. Your health is precious. You are rich, respected, admired, beloved. You are happy as I once was. You are a man to be missed. For me it is no matter. We will go back. You will be ill, and I cannot be responsible. Besides, there is Luceschi." "Enough," he said. "The cough is mere nothing. It will not kill me. I shall not die of a cough." "True, true," I replied, "and indeed I had no intention of alarming you unnecessarily, but you should use all proper caution. A draught of this medoc will defend us from this damps, or defend us from the damps, rather." Here I knocked off the neck of a bottle which I drew from a long row of its fellows that lay upon the mould. "Drink," I said, presenting him the wine. He raised it to his lips with a leer. He paused and nodded to me familiarly, while his bells jingled. "I drink," he said, "to the buried that repose around us." And I replied, "And I to your long life." He again took my arm, and we proceeded. "These vaults," he said, "are extensive." "The Montresors," I replied, "were a great and numerous family." "I forgot your arms." "A huge human foot d'or in a field azure, the foot crushes a serpent rampant whose fangs are embedded in the heel." "And the motto?" "Nemo me impuni lacessit." "Good," he said. The wine sparkled in his eyes and the bells jingled. My own fancy grew warm with the medoc. We had passed through the walls of piled bones, with casks and puncheons intermingling, into the inmost recesses of the catacombs. I paused again, and this time I made bold to seize Fortunato by an arm above the elbow. "The nitre," I said. "See, it increases. It hangs like moss upon the vaults. We are below the river's bed. The drops of moisture trickle among the bones. Come, we will go back ere it is too late. Your cough." "It is nothing," he said. "Let us go on. But first another draught of the medoc." I broke and reached him a flagon of De Grave. He emptied it at a breath. His eyes flashed with a fierce light. He laughed and threw the bottle upwards with a gesticulation I did not understand. I looked at him in surprise. He repeated the movement, a grotesque one. "You do not comprehend?" he said. "Not I," I replied. "Then you are not of the Brotherhood." "How?" "You are not of the Masons." "Yes, yes," I said. "Yes, yes." "You? Impossible. A Mason?" "A Mason," I replied. "A sign," he said. "It is this," I answered, producing a towel from beneath the folds of my roquelaure. "You jest," he exclaimed, recoiling a few paces. "But let us proceed to the Amontillado." "Be it so," I said, replacing the tool beneath the cloak and again offering him my arm. He leaned upon it heavily. We continued our route in search of the Amontillado. We passed through a range of low arches, descended, passed on, and descending again, arriving at a deep crypt, in which the foulness of the air caused our flambeau rather to glow than flame. At the most remote end of the crypt, there appeared another less spacious. Its walls had been lined with human remains, piled to the vault overhead, in the fashion of the great catacombs of Paris. Three sides of this interior crypt were still ornamented in this matter. From the fourth, the bones had been thrown down and lay promiscuously upon the earth, forming at one point a mound of quite some size. Within the wall, thus exposed by the displacing of the bones, we perceived the still interior recess, in depth about 4 feet, in width 3, in height 6 or 7. It seemed to have been constructed for no especial use within itself, but formed merely the interval between two of the colossal supports of the roof of the catacombs, and was backed by one of their circumscribing walls of solid granite. It was in vain that Fortunato, uplifting his dull torch, endeavored to pry into the depth of the recess. Its termination, the feeble light, did not enable us to see. "Proceed," I said. "Herein is the Amontillado. As for Luchesi..." "He is an ignoramus," interrupted my friend, as he stepped unsteadily forward, while I followed him immediately at his heels. In an instant he had reached the extremity of the niche, and finding his progress arrested by the rock, stood stupidly bewildered. A moment more, and I had fettered him to the granite. In its surface were two iron staples, distant from each other about 2 feet horizontally. From one of these depended a short chain, and from the other a padlock. Throwing the links about his waist, it was but the work of a few seconds to secure it. He was much too astounded to resist. Withdrawing the key, I stepped back from the recess. "Pass your hand," I said, "over the wall. You cannot help feeling the nitre. Indeed, it is very damp. Once more, let me implore you to return." "No? Then I must positively leave you. But I must first render you all the little attentions in my power." "The Amontillado!" ejaculated my friend, not yet recovered from his astonishment. "True," I replied, "the Amontillado." As I said these words, I busied myself among the pile of bones of which I had before spoken. Throwing them aside, I soon uncovered a quantity of building stone and mortar. With these materials, and with the aid of my trowel, I began vigorously to wall up the entrance of the niche. I had scarcely laid the first tier of the masonry when I discovered that the intoxication of Fortunato had in a great measure worn off. The earliest indication I had of this was a low moaning cry from the depths of the recess. It was not the cry of a drunken man. Then there was a long and obstinate silence. I laid the second tier and the third and the fourth, and then I heard the furious vibrations of the chain. The noise lasted for several minutes, during which, that I might hearken to it with the most satisfaction, I ceased my labors and sat down upon the bones. When at last the clanking subsided, I resumed the trowel and finished without interruption the fifth, the sixth, and the seventh tier. The wall was now nearly upon a level with my breast. I again paused, and holding the flambeau over the mason work, threw a few feeble rays upon the figure within. A succession of loud and shrill screams, bursting suddenly from the throat of the chained form, seemed to thrust me violently back. For a brief moment I hesitated. I trembled. Unsheathing my rapier, I began to grope with it about the recess, but the thought of an instant reassured me. I placed my hand upon the solid fabric of the catacombs and felt satisfied. I reapproached the wall. I replied to the yells of him who clamored. I re-echoed, I aided, I surpassed them in volume and in strength. I did this, and the clamorer grew still. It was now midnight, and my task was drawing to a close. I had completed the 8th, the 9th, and the 10th tier. I had finished a portion of the last and the 11th, and there remained but with a single stone to be fitted and plastered in. I struggled with its weight. I placed it partially in its destined position. But now there came from out the niche a low laugh that erected the hairs upon my head. It was succeeded by a sad voice, which I had difficulty in recognizing as that of the noble Fortunato. The voice said,
"Ha, ha, ha, ha! A very good joke indeed, an excellent jest. We'll have many a rich laugh about it at the palazzo, over our wine."
"The Amontillado," I said.
"Yes, yes, the Amontillado. But is it not getting late? Will they not be awaiting us at the palazzo, the Lady Fortunato and the rest? Let us be gone."
"Yes," I said, "let us be gone."
"For the love of God, Montresor."
"Yes," I said, "for the love of God." But to these words I hearkened in vain for a reply. I grew impatient. I called aloud, "Fortunato!" No answer. I called again,
"Fortunato!"
No answer still. I thrust a torch through the remaining aperture and let it fall within. There came forth in return only a jingling of the bells. My heart grew sick on account of the dampness of the catacombs. I hastened to make an end of my labor. I forced the last stone into its position. I plastered it up. Against the new masonry, I re-erected the old rampart of bones. For the half a century, no mortal has disturbed them. In pace requiescat. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of the story. I'm going to play you a musical piece now entitled The Cask of Amontillado by the Alan Parsons Project. Then we'll return and start up the second half of the hour with the essay by Catherine Harris.
Thank you.
Do you understand what I'm telling you?
The Hour of the Time may be contacted at HOTT, that's H-O-T-T, P.O. Box 940, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, in the state of Arizona, 85925. Our phone number is 928-333-2942, and our website is www.hourofthetime.com. This next piece is Ironic Revenge in Poe's The Cask of Amontillado by Catherine M. Harris. Now, we'll be reading from pretty much the whole thing from Catherine here, and then we have some other excerpts, analysis of The Cask of Amontillado from other sources. And Karen's piece starts like this. The Cask of Amontillado has been less often read for itself than used to support theories about Poe's life, his psyche, or his narrative technique. It well illustrates his obsession with live burial and his burial, rather, and his use of sadism as a gothic device, and it meets exactly the criteria of unity and economy set out in his review of Hawthorne's Twice Told Tales. But such readings separate theme and form, emphasizing one at the other's expense, and neglect the irony of Montresor's trowel, that symbol of brotherhood and instrument of death. This irony gives coherence to the images of the tale and to many of Montresor's apparently gratuitous sadistic sarcasms, and suggests a motive for murder as well. From the beginning of the tale, Montresor has a motive, or thinks he does. The thousand injuries of Fortunato I had borne as best I could, but when he ventured upon insult, I vowed revenge. Now, the chill grows as we progressively discover that Montresor, a connoisseur of the ironic, has a premeditated plan. Relying on Fortunato's envy and pride and his weakness for wine, which is apparent in the tale, he has arranged for his servants to desert for the holidays, and he carries an ominous trowel beneath his cloak. The cave has been recently swept of old bones, and suddenly the plan is clear, entombment. And just as his revelation of the trowel at midpoint in their journey underground confirms the existence of a plan, its irony suggests his motive. When Montresor is surprised by a gesture of Fortunato's, Fortunato underscores his lack of comprehension. Fortunato is a Freemason, and Montresor is not. And then she goes into some dialogue from the tale. Then you were not of the Brotherhood. How? You were not of the Masons. Yes, yes, I said. Yes, yes. You. Impossible. A Mason? A Mason, I replied. A sign, he said, a sign. And it's at this point that Montresor shows him the trowel that he has hidden under his cloak. Earlier in the tale, Montresor has gathered to himself several details that have religious, and in this particular case, Catholic associations. The coat of arms, for example, of the House of Montresor, with its vengeful motto, Nemo me impune lacessit, is more than a simple revenge motive. The circuitous device, a huge human foot d'or in a field of azure, the foot crushes a serpent rampant whose fangs are embedded in the heel, is taken from, of course, the curse upon the serpent in Genesis 3, verse 14. This is not an image of an impartial revenge, but the traditional representation of the church militant in its triumph over the forces of evil in retribution for Adam's fall, caused by the snake, I guess. Now, the cask is set at carnival time, which is a Catholic season, just before Lent, and the tale itself begins as a confession. The underground passages below the Palazzo are literally the catacombs of the Montresors, but the phrase also recalls the history of the early church. The wine they seek, though its Eucharistic significance is never elaborated on, appropriately suggests through its non-existence the ironic perversion of Montresor's religious devotion. Montresor's pun on Mason is dramatized when he falls Fortunato behind 11 courses of carefully laid stone. Now, you know what the 11 probably symbolizes, ladies and gentlemen, are the 11 rites of the, I believe it's the York Rite of Freemasonry that has 11. Also the Swedish Rite, of Freemasonry. 11 levels of initiation. Now, continuing from Catherine's work here. He consistently describes his handiwork as masonry or mason work. And in the final paragraph, among the double-edged words against and re-erected and the relics that may represent the church, the word is surely symbolic. Against the new masonry, I re-erected the old rampart of bones. The story ends on a resoundingly Catholic note. In pace requiescat, the final words of the Requiem Mass. Now, although the occasion for murder is as mysterious as ever, it is clear that the hostility between the two characters is worked out in terms of the Catholic-Masonic opposition. This is not to say that Poe necessarily saw his tale as a morality play, a cataclysmic battle between good and evil. Nor is it probable that Montresor is much more of a Catholic than Poe needed for the plot. Catholicism, like all other aspects of medieval life, was for Poe a Gothic device, just simply used to intensify effect. Among Roderick Usher's favorite books are a small octavo edition of the Directorium Inquisitorium, his chief delight, a rare and curious book in quarto Gothic, the Vigilae Mortuatum Secundum Chorum Ecclesia And I apologize, ladies and gentlemen, for the pronunciation there. My Latin isn't what she once was. Actually, it's probably getting better because I never was very good at Latin at all. Now, the Inquisition is the source of horror in The Pit and the Pendulum, and the Church and Immurement are linked in The Black Cat, whose protagonist conceals his wife's body in a wall in the cellar, as the monks of the Middle Ages are recorded to have walled up their victims. Montresor's Catholicism, even if it is only nominal and melodramatic, is essential to the unity of the story. At the beginning, Montresor gives us two criteria for revenge. A wrong, he says, is unredressed when retribution overtakes its redresser. It is equally unredressed when the avenger fails to make himself felt as such to him who has done the wrong. The first requirement is fulfilled. No retribution seems to have overtaken Montresor. He does not speak from prison. His tone is never remorseful, at least until the very end of the tale. And in spite of the use in the story of religious trappings, there's no hint of divine retribution. But it is clearly understood that he has sinned at the end. Is the voice haunting him or what? We never know. But the second criterion is a loose end, a violation of narrative economy if Fortunato dies without understanding why. Now, knowing Montresor is a Catholic, we, like Fortunato, can hear the irony of what we have been seen as a villain's final sadistic sarcasms and understand the terms on which the revenge has been undertaken. By the time the first course is laid, the intoxication of Fortunato has in a great measure worn off, according to the text. Now, he is sober enough to see Montresor's intent, to scream, to protest that he has seen the jest. He is even sober enough to beg for the love of God, and to hear more than mere mockery in the reply when Montresor says, "Yes, I said, for the love of God." So it's clearly obvious here, ladies and gentlemen, that Montresor is anti-Mason. And he's doing it because he believes it's God's will. It is a declaration of motive, a triumphant boast, and the understanding silences Fortunato. And then finally the last stone on the 11th tier is wedged into place, and the final irony of the Mason being shut up and killed with masonry. The final line, in pace requiescat, is not an expression of sanctimonious contentment, a plea to be freed of guilt, or a sarcasm uttered as Montresor sees that Fortunato died without recognizing that his murder was an act of vengeance. It is an appropriate ironic comment on the death of a Mason, a sanctification of Montresor's private auto da fe. Now, whether our failure to see the Masonic-Catholic conflict in this story has been the result of modern preoccupation with the mental aberration and motiveless evil of Edgar Allan Poe, or of Edgar Allan Poe's failure to work out the conflict clearly, permitting his irony to give itself away more readily, the Cask of Amontillado is a more coherent tale than has been once thought. Its details of horror are not merely decorative sadism, but part of an ironic vengeance, and Montresor, whether his plan is evidence of sanity or madness, has what was in Poe's world at least what seems to constitute a motive for murder. And that, ladies and gentlemen, was written by Catherine M. Harris. That's her analysis of the Catholic-Masonic conflict. Now, the Cask of Amontillado, according to enotes.com, was first published in November 1846 in an issue of Godet's Ladies' Book. Apparently this was a monthly magazine out of Philadelphia in the great U.S. of A., published poems and stories by some of the American writers of the best American writers of the 19th century. And apparently it was next included in a collection of Poe's works edited by Rufus W. Griswold, Poe's literary executor in 1850. He was already nationally known by the time Poe wrote this. 1845, he had originally released The Raven, which, of course, is one of his more famous pieces. Now, it seems like the Cask of Amontillado was not singled out for any specific attention when it appeared in any literary reviews, and but it has remained pretty much continuously in print since 1850. And, of course, the story is narrated by our Catholic Montresor, who carries... We're not sure why he carries a grudge against Fortunato. We're never told that. The offense that Fortunato has done has never adequately explained in the text. Anyways, that's why we're searching here for more meaning, ladies and gentlemen. Is there mystery behind the Masonic symbolism that we're seeing in it? Now, of course, we know that he takes him on a tour through the catacombs of his basement and underneath his palace, I guess, into a wine chamber on the promise of giving him a bottle of this or having a taste of this fancy wine. Of course, at the end, the two men reach the last underground chamber, and this is where Fortunato is chained to the wall and is sealed in. Now, other critics in the mid-century, 1950s here we're talking about now, in the 1900s, 1950s, 1960s, they were concerned with exploring the significance of the details in the story that certainly readers might not be expected to understand without further explanation. So we have we have Catherine Montgomery Harris here, this is the one analysis that we're doing, and James E. Rocks in the Poe Noodles newsletter from 1972 also analyzed the conflict in the story between the Roman Catholic Montresor and Fortunato, definitely here in Mason. Now, James E. Rocks concludes, that Montresor kills Fortunato because he must protect God's word and his church against his enemies. Now, other writers in the same period explored the significance of the names Montresor, Fortunato, and Amontillado. And that's something we may do in the future here as well. I was able to find some information on that from some of the various Edgar Allan Poe sites on the web. There's an Edgar Allan Poe Society of Baltimore, and on their website there was quite a bit of analysis done on the Mason/Catholic slant. You know, the one piece here that I have that I'd like to quote from, this is from the Loyola University of Chicago, and this is, once again, James E. Rocks, but this is from the Edgar Allan Poe Society of Baltimore's website. This is where he detail some of his analysis. So let me read just a few paragraphs from this. Critical commentary on the Cask of Amontillado has tended to dismiss the question of Montresor's motive in killing Fortunato, but the tone of the story betrays the narrator confused and troubled by the guilt of a vengeful murder that has deprived him of spiritual peace and sanctifying grace, because he is convinced of the righteousness of his act. His uneasy conscience has become a kind of retribution for his crime, and the benediction at the end, the conclusion of the story, is ironic in the light of his own spiritual isolation and psychological unrest, and his knowledge that his own soul may be damned by this mortal sin. Fortunato and Montresor were political enemies, although in the book, Montresor always says, friend. He feels that the act of killing Fortunato here, though, is motivated by the Catholics' hatred and fear of the Brotherhood of Freemasonry. And this is where he talks again about, yes, for the love of God. And Montresor replies to Fortunato, yes, I said, for the love of God. Where he seals him up finally, believing this to be God's will. Now, Montresor's execution of vengeance against Fortunato, partaking somewhat of an Old Testament morality, is the work of a man who believes he must protect God's word and his church against the enemies, and who demonstrates his love of God in this deed. A defender of the faith, Montresor may also be like the prophet who feels the command of God to undertake a mission of retributive justice. In addition, he may be the political man who has felt his family name and heritage threatened by the power and domination of this faithless secret society. As Fellheim notes, when Montresor refers to Fortunato's death early in the story as an immolation, he is suggesting a kind of religious sacrifice, with himself to be designated as the sacrificial priest. Now, we're not sure, ladies and gentlemen, when this story was supposedly taking place. It's unclear in the narrative, so it could be set during the period of forthright Catholic rejection of Freemasonry. This is what James Rocks theorizes here. And it even could have gone as late as the 18th century. In 1738, of course, Pope Clement XII condemned Freemasonry in his bull In Eminenti. Clement declared that those who joined the fraternity were excommunicated because the beliefs of Freemasonry made it a secret and pagan religion and a possible threat to the church and state. He condemned their oaths and rituals, and after 1738, many of the largely Catholic countries were trying to suppress Freemasonry. As a Freemason, and thus a heretic, Fortunato would automatically be excommunicated, and therefore in Montresor's deranged mind, without the benefits of communion in the Catholic Church. No better than the infidels whom the Crusaders killed. As a political enemy of the Church, Fortunato would be a threat to its secular domination. Also, his Masonic sign, which Montresor calls grotesque, would be, by command of the Pope, offensive. Montresor appointed himself the agent of retribution against this enemy of God, and clearly turned Fortunato's Freemasonry against him in the plan of murder. It's not surprising that as a faithful Catholic, Montresor should later be disturbed by his deed, even if he cannot define those feelings precisely, or experience genuine remorse. As ladies and gentlemen, his discontent is intensified by a strong sense that his wrongs have not been wholly redressed, that he has failed in his vengeance against this religious and political enemy. Now, because of the complexity of his motivations and personality, Montresor is a character of considerable importance and interest in Gothic fiction. On account of its irony, The Cask of Amontillado can be read in a variety of ways, not the least of which should take the cognizance of the Catholic-Masonic conflict, the source of which can be traced both to fact and fiction of the time. Now, we're going to continue here with a little bit more of an analysis. This one from Kent Bales, from the University of Minnesota. A Roman Catholic aristocrat takes revenge on his Freemason enemy by walling him into a corner of the family catacombs, thus destroying his life and freedom by masonry. Now, to most readers, this is an audacious pun, but to anti-Masonic readers, it is poetic justice as well. The remains of Fortunato, the hapless Mason, will lie among the bones of his Roman Catholic enemies, the great and numerous Montresors, while the present Montresor lives on. Anti-Masonic readers may be few today, but in the 1840s, they too would have been numerous. Now, there were even, at that time, a lot of anti-Catholic readers when Poe's work came out, and many of would have hated both Masons and Catholics. So this Protestant audience would be ready to believe just about anything about monks and nuns, and, you know, to be very worried about any of the Protestants that may come under the iron fist of these, this Catholic Church. So this author here is suggesting that Poe constructs a dramatic irony far subtler in its machinery than was usual for Gothic tales of the time. Now, the irony is generated by the opening and closing paragraphs spoken to somebody in the present and framing the tale to which Montresor tells you who so well know the nature of my soul. Encountering these words at the outset, the reader assumes that he is being addressed, but as the horror mounts, and as we discover in the final paragraph that the events took place 50 years ago, a more distant relationship of reader to teller takes shape. It appears at this point we may be hearing the final confession of a dying man, because this is, of course, 50 years later. He's saying the bones at the end of the tale were undisturbed for these last 50 years. And that while we may not know the nature of Montresor's soul, we're certainly ignorant of this great secret that he's telling us in this tale. Now, this tale is triumphantly told as Montresor prepares to take his treasure, his apparently successful revenge, into the grave, free from retribution, or so he thinks. This freedom is necessary to revenge, for according to Montresor, a wrong is unredressed when retribution overtakes its redresser. But vengeance is the Lord's, as Poe's contemporaries would have known, and despite Montresor's motto, in a Christian universe, no private vengeance can be exacted with impunity. And a mortal sin unrepented brings eternal retribution, even when it is confessed, especially when it is confessed with relish. The Protestant Christian audience can indulge their ideological hatreds by justly condemning Montresor to hell on the strength of his professed beliefs, which in this matter they share. Any modern reader able to share that audience's response will more fully enjoy the rich, ironic effects of this tale. So, what do you think of that, ladies and gentlemen? Interesting little twist. I'd like to thank a fellow researcher and supporter of the Hour of the Time, Ray, for helping us out with some of this research. We've expanded on it a little bit, and of course read the Cask of Amontillado as well, so that you can have this all in one package if you'd like to tape this program or pick up the tape from us. As you're probably aware, during the month of March here, we are offering a sale. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to thank you for listening to the Hour of the Time. Today is Wednesday, March 16th, and this has been The Cask of Amontillado by Edgar Allan Poe, an analysis by the Hour of the Time. Thanks for listening, ladies and gentlemen. God bless each and every one of you. Take care.
When they come for me, there will be another battle. I will not give up, and I don't care who wins or loses, because at the end of my battle, It will be just the beginning of yours.
The Hour of the Time may be contacted at HOTT, that's H-O-T-T, P.O. Box 940, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, in the state of Arizona, 85925. Our phone number is 928-333-2942, and our website is www.hourofthetime.com.
A nation or world of people who will not use their intelligence are no better than animals who do not have intelligence. Such people are stakes on the table and beasts of burden by choice and consent.
The Hour of the Time may be contacted at HOTT, that's H-O-T-T, P.O. Box 940, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, in the state of Arizona, 85925. Our phone number is 928-333-2942, and our website is www.hourofthetime.com. Thank you. The hour of the time may be contacted at HOTT, that's H-O-T-T, P.O. Box 940, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, in the state of Arizona, 85925. Our phone number is 928-333-2942, and our website is www.hourofthetime.com.